This podcast is sponsored by Sophie Reaptress. She makes cave suits and some of the best cave suits. She's working on my wife's right now, and my wife wants a bat stencil. Sophie will give you a bat stencil. She'll put one wherever you want. And she offers her cave suits in a variety of colors. My wife's getting the olive green, which I think is one of her more common colors, but she'll customize it in any way you want. It fits a lot of body types. And she started making cave suits because she found that there weren't a ton of options out there. And the ones that are out there are good, but she wanted to be another one, and a particularly good one. She's got experience. She started making leggings years ago. She's expanded from there, and now cave suits are among the things that she sells at SophieReaptress.com. And, I mean, just one look at these cave suits and you'll understand. So visit the website or visit her on Instagram, Sophie Reaptress. She's got like 30,000 plus followers. And here's what comes standard in her cave suits. They're made of 500 denier cordura and twice as thick where you need it. And you know where you need it if you're a caver. Knees, butts, elbows, that kind of thing. So these will hold up. So if you want to get serious about caving, get a cave suit from Sophie Reaptress. SophieReaptress.com. You can order right there. Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. A grotto is a caving club, and you should join one if you're interested in caving. It's where you'll meet new people, get new opportunities to go on trips. And we recommend this because we do not recommend caving by yourself or caving with people who do not have experience, because it's like a lot of things. It's dangerous if you don't know what you're doing, if you don't have experience, quite the opposite once you do. Or if you're with people who know what they're doing, and you'll learn from those people. So find your local grotto, which is a local chapter of the National Speleological Society. You can visit their website to find your local grotto, caves.org. Pretty easy to remember, caves.org. And get in touch with grotto leadership. They'll let you know about the calendar of events, what trips are coming, difficulties of the caves coming up on those trips, all that information. They'll be glad to share it with you. Hello, if you're headed to OTR, I wish I could be there with you. I'm very glad to be your company on your way there or on your way back, maybe. I had such a great time at Indiana Cave Capers at the beginning of the month. Got to see a cave that's been on my list for a long time, Breathing Hole Cave. I climbed down, did it with Laura Demarest, who's been on the podcast before. Joe Kinder was there. He's been on. That was episode 2, I think. Tristan Stahl, plus some other people who I want to have on the podcast, including Mike Drake. Mike, if you're listening, we got to talk, man. He got Caver of the Year at Capers this year for the work that he's done in Studebaker Pit, which was connected into Wayne Cave, which is one of the longer caves in Indiana. Wayne Cave is now a 5-mile cave thanks to the work that he's done in Stu. And I cannot wait to get that story from him. What a huge, huge piece of news in the Indiana caving world that's been over the last few years. And I'm just glad I can finally kind of talk freely about it. Mike, we got to get you on. Had such a great time at Capers, hosted the banquet, did a lot of napping. It was a hot weekend, and I sweated out in the tent. But it was just, you know, Capers is like my weekend to myself. As a dedicated father of 2 little kids, you know, I don't get to leave the house much. And my wife is like, look, Capers is yours. Do whatever you want. And so I caught up on sleep and fun. And so it was great. If we hung out at Capers, thank you for making it one of the greatest weekends of the year that I always, always look forward to. And if you didn't make it, I got to see you there next year. Speaking of which, next month's episode was recorded at Capers. I'll tell you who it was in the outro, but let me get to Patty. So Patty Cummings is the vice president of the Richard Blends Nature Conservancy, which is the property where Buckner Cave is. And you've heard me talk about Buckner a lot, I'm sure, if you've listened to this podcast before. I love Buckner. It's just a great cave. The main route that most people take is, you know, it's a great introduction to caving. Not that it's an easy cave. It's not at all. It's a good introduction because it shows you a little bit of everything. And if you can make it through the Buckner Circle route, you are a caver, especially if you liked it. And I've taken dragged a lot of people that I know through that cave. And some of them will never come back, but always look back on it fondly as like, I did that, I survived that kind of thing, which to me is part of what caving is all about. It was a joy for me to talk to Patty because she and I corresponded a lot when I was the chair of the Central Indiana Grotto, because that was when Dick passed away. He passed away during my tenure as chair of the CIG, died on my birthday, 2018. And so Patty and I talk a lot about what it was like when that happened and cleaning out the house and turning it into this sort of repository for the BIG libraries, the Bloomington, Indiana Grotto libraries, and the CIG library, and cleaning up the house of someone who lived there for decades and an eccentric person. We get into that. And, you know, just Dick's legacy of allowing people onto his property and into the cave, and the goodwill that he extended upon people who then, you know, became lifelong cavers, some of which whose names you've heard. Bill Steele, who's been on the podcast, got part of his start there in Bloomington. Derek Bristol as well. And just so many, you know, big name cavers who you might say are cavers because of Dick Blends. So we talk a lot about that. And just to give you some context, we talk about her son, Chuck, who sadly passed away in 2020, who was also a caver. And later, we also talk about the recovery of Tim McLean, who died of a massive heart attack on a caving trip in Indiana. And if you're an Indiana caver, you know what I'm talking about. But in case you don't, there's that. She was involved with the recovery. She was stationed at the entrance, and kind of give some interesting perspective on what that was like. This was so nice. I love Patty, and I loved talking to Patty Cummings. Hey, how's it going? I'm sorry about all this technology.
That's okay.
Garbage.
I hate technology.
Me too. Me too. Nothing makes me more enraged than when technology doesn't work, even though I have no idea how to fix it.
And that's why I like simple technology. Like, give me a rock hammer.
Exactly. Right? There's some caver logic for you. So when did you start caving, Patty?
New Year's Day of 1985.
You've got it down to the day. Wait, New Year's Day. What was the occasion?
New Year's Day.
Okay.
Joellen and Dawn. I'd met Joellen through going to school, and she and I kind of gravitated toward one another because there weren't that many older women students in the class, and we kept asking each other's questions, and we became friends. And she said I had a caver personality, and so that New Year's Day, we both had time off from work, and she said, let's go. So we took my 4-year-old and 6-year-old sons and my then husband, and we went to Sullivan Cave with Dawn Paquette and Joellen.
My first cave, too. What'd you do? Do you remember the route?
We did 7 hours. So we did Armstrong's Folly. We did the popcorn crawl.
Wow.
We did, you know, and the kids were great. The kids absolutely loved it.
Crawl for the first trip, that didn't psych you out?
Well, I didn't know any better. And it was, you know, it was just get through it. Okay.
Oh, my goodness.
And with Dawn as a teacher and Joellen, you know, my kids were having a ball. You know, what's not to love about it?
And I mean, you know, Sullivan Cave, very important to your current partner, Sam, you know, he drew the map.
Yeah.
How much of Sullivan have you seen since then, since beginning your caving career? Have you seen, have you been all the way up to the top?
No.
No?
Nah. Now, I am not the great caver. I am wonderful support. And I am basically a butts and boot heel kind of caver. I follow other people. You know, I enjoy it thoroughly, but I am not the great adventurer that many other cavers are.
But have you been past, been north of the quarry room?
I think so.
Yeah, probably. Hit that deep water and those bathtubs and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that where you would say the bug bit you? Was that trip, or did it take a few more before you were like, all right, I guess I'm a caver now?
No, it was that trip. It was like, you know, coming home.
Yeah.
It was just the realization that, you know, that all, it all felt right.
So obviously you went and continued after that. You were already in Bloomington, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there was a lot to offer. So it was like this opened the door, and then I don't know. Did you know that there were a lot of caves around, or did you only learn that after you became interested?
I knew about some of the caves. I knew about, you know, we'd been to McCormick's Creek, and we'd been to that cave there.
Yeah, yeah.
And spent, you know, ever since I was a kid, I would been going into caves. But the first official wild trip where I didn't get a beating afterwards for when people found out where I was with Sullivan's. So, you know, I was always just crawling under things. Yeah, just I started going to the meetings at Joe Ellen's encouragement.
BIG meetings?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And went to a few of the CIG meetings, but it wasn't as convenient. And, you know, poor little kids, stuff like that. So, you know, just couldn't take that much time out of the schedule to go to CIG meetings.
Then when you moved on from Sullivan Cave, what came next?
Buckner.
Yeah.
Of course. And we did a lot of cleanups there. Reeves Cave. Is that Reeves Cave where my helmet caught on fire because there was a crack in my carbide lamp?
Oh, no.
And so as I'm doing that climb up, you know, Bill Bouse came over the edge of it and blew out the flames on my head. Just about the time I was thinking, this carbide lamp is really working well. Nobody else's light seems to be working so well. Well, it was because I had, you know, large flames coming off the top of my helmet.
Oh, no. Well, how'd you get out then after that? I mean, did you have a backup carbide light on you?
Yeah, I'm real good at following other people's lights, too.
Okay.
I'm fairly good in low light, so... as long as there's no huge abyss in front of me, I can usually get along.
So what was the state of Buckner then on your first few trips? I mean, it was the 80s, so it wasn't great.
Well, put it this way. My oldest son, who was bit with the caving bug really big, on every Buckner trip, he would gather up the various pieces of flashlights and such.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we would always bring out a bag of trash and he would sort out the flashlight bits and pieces. And so he built a huge collection of Frankenlights where he rebuilt these things and into usable lights. And they weren't pretty, but they worked. And so every trip was a cleanup.
I mean, every trip is a cleanup for me too. I mean, there's still a good amount of trash in there, and I'll try to grab a few pieces, whatever I can fit into my pack. I grabbed a piece of a cooler that I found somewhere in the lower levels, you know, that had kind of washed somewhere. I think that anybody going into Buckner should at least carry one or two pieces of trash out with them. I mean, there's, you know, it's come a long way as I understand it, but there's still an awful lot more in there.
Oh, yeah. A lot of it requires, you know, shoving Boy Scouts, you know, tiny Boy Scouts into very narrow spots and telling them, we'll let you out when you bring out some trash.
Did it smell at that time? I heard that Buckner used to stink because of all the trash.
It depended on when you went in. In midwinter, it wasn't nearly so bad.
I guess not. So would you say then that you've seen the majority of Buckner since then?
Yeah.
Yeah,
probably.
Where haven't you been, would you say?
I haven't been to just underneath the pit that they opened up for, you know, doing the rescues where I think it was Jeff Rogers maybe built some weird ladder in order to try to get access for the that caving club, the rival caving club, when we stopped letting Buddy send people to the to Buckner without permission.
Wait.
And so then they built a ladder there at the pit entrance that we had dug open.
The one in the middle of that, the monument passage?
I think so.
I can't remember the name of that pit. It's on the map. I can't recall. I mean, I'm always intrigued by that entrance. I don't even know if you can call it an entrance anymore whenever I pass underneath of it.
Well, it's closed up now and it's pretty inaccessible. I mean, Sam could find it.
Yeah,
but
I'm sure
it takes some work.
We're talking a lot about Buckner because you are kind of now among the caretakers of the Richard Blends Nature Conservancy, which is where Buckner is located. How did I imagine there's a number of different ways you got involved with that racket, but what was the genesis of becoming involved? I mean, you can go to Buckner, sure, but to get involved with Buckner is kind of a different thing.
Well, it was a lot. That was, my oldest son contributed a lot to my caving experiences and such. And he was, as a 12-year-old, would sneak out of the house on days that his father and I were at work and ride his bicycle from our house to Buckner and go solo caving with Dick Blends' permission.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would come home and try to be home and cleaned up before we got home from work. And then he would lie to us about where he'd been. But we've, you know, at the next BIG meeting, Dick takes me to the side and says, well, you know where your son is during, you know, some of these summer days, right? I'm like, I have my suspicions since you're talking to me about it. And just over the years, you know, we just got real active at Buckner. And, you know, there was just so many events going on and got to be good friends with Dick. And just, you know, when the Richard Blends Nature Conservancy got developed, because that was a little bit after Art Gayheimer was working there.
Right.
Was living out there. And so
chasing people away.
He let some people in. He was, you know, he was a pretty good filter.
Yeah, but that was the whole point, is that it needed a filter, and Art was the filter, right?
Yeah, Dick had been threatened before. There, one guy had said, old man, how do you feel about having your house burned down? And that bothered Dick a little bit, because he knew he was out there by himself. And, you know, there were people who shouldn't have been out there were showing up regularly. So Art was a very useful person there. My older son did live out there about 25 years ago. He lived about a year out at Dick's place, lived in the basement, as many a caver has done. So he started working with Dick on getting things updated as far as the cave files, and, you know, did regular runs in the cave to, you know, kind of, you know, filtering people out, leading them out, and, you know, did the weekly sweep and rescue to get people who were lost out. And it just kind of grew from there. And so once the RBNC became a thing, and Dick had been working about getting everything deeded over to the NSS, when we realized that there needed to be something going on, I became vice president, Anmar the president, Sam the secretary, and Dick was the treasurer for years.
Mm-hmm.
And then Dick decided that he was going to step back from that a little bit. And Sam's been the treasurer and secretary since then.
So I've seen the house. It's a decent house. It's not huge, but he lived there, lived in the basement.
Yeah.
Had like just a corner or what? Because there's
before it got cleaned up, it was interesting to say the least.
Okay.
One of the place that Chuck's room was the had been formerly the studio, because there had been a recording studio built in the basement. So when that was no longer a recording studio, it became more of a storage area, and it was just a convenient place for a caver to bunk down. I mean, Chuck was working two jobs all the time, so basically he just needed a place to sleep.
What was the story about the recording studio? I think you've shared it with me once or twice before, but what, how did that come to be?
There was a caver that was out there with some frequency, and he was a musician, and he was probably more of a musician than he was a caver. And he talked Dick into doing a recording studio, because Dick had a big background in building radios and things like that. So the technology side of it attracted Dick's interest. And so they built the recording studio in there. And that actually was a lot to do with the decline of Buckner in general, because then it started to attract more musicians and less cavers. And the musicians had less interest in preserving anything, or, you know, taking care of the cave property at all. And then it just pretty much degenerated into a party place, where it was just convenient to go into the cave and party if it was hot or cold and you just wanted to go drink some beer, and not so much the caving, as it was a novel place to party.
Interesting. Now, I don't want to make you like speak for him or anything like that. I mean, obviously Dick's gone and he was wonderful in a lot of ways, but in some ways it seemed like he sort of allowed this kind of thing. Or did he? Was he just too old to do anything about it? Was he just, I don't know, was he just too friendly to want to say anything about it, about this decline of, I don't know, the caliber of people that were visiting the cave and whether or not they were respecting the property?
Well, Dick had two jobs too.
Yeah, yeah.
Dick spent years and years working at IU, and he also worked at Ivy Tech. And so he was gone sometimes, you know, 18 hours a day. And so he didn't have as much control. We didn't have a gate. And Dick always hoped that people would be respectful enough. And he did tend to, you know, I think hold out high hopes.
Yeah.
That people would, you know, see the stuff and appreciate it and take care of it, as opposed to thinking, well, you know, this is something I can get away with.
So people just, they just came. They didn't care. He had faith.
Advantage.
He had faith in people that maybe he shouldn't have.
Yeah. In his later years, he got a little less faithful about people. But
it took a long time, though, it seemed like, because for this to happen and continue to happen for a while. I mean, it's not like the guy quit caving in the 70s. You know, he was still doing it. He was seeing what was happening. And it still took someone like Art coming in and filtering people out.
There have been other efforts over the years.
Yeah.
I know Mike Meeson at one point tried to get things cleaned up. I know that Sam and Kevin Komisarek, you know, made efforts to help get things cleaned up. And Drew Pacman, Bill Bouse, you know, there were a lot of people who made efforts. But then when Dick didn't back us up because, you know, he didn't have the time because he wasn't there and he didn't have anybody there, you know, strong arming people, a lot of regular cavers started to look in other areas to go caving. And I remember there being the big discussion between IKC and other groups as far as gating caves. And the discussion of gating caves oftentimes got rather volatile. There were times I thought people were going to trade blows. And it was decided at one point that Buckner would be sort of a sacrificial cave.
I still hear that Buckner is a sacrificial cave.
It is, in that we let people without much experience go, but we do try to make sure that there's at least one or two people on each trip with experience. And by keeping it cleaned up, we're hoping that it will set a better example. But it is a place where people get an opportunity to learn without being exposed to the more pristine caves, where they're more likely to make damage due to their ignorance.
Mm. Was Buckner gated? Because there is that, the small gate, and we're working on another one?
Yeah. It wasn't gated until that small gate was placed in the right at the entrance of the crawlway.
Right, right.
A few years ago. There were no gates. There was just, you know, there was a gate accessing for the property, but it didn't keep a lot of people out. People would just park at the end of the road.
Was that small gate at the crawlway, was that only added after his death? I can't remember if that was added just before he passed or after. I guess what I'm wondering is, did Dick have an aversion to gating the cave?
Yes.
He did? Okay.
He wanted people to have access to the cave. He was a firm believer that if people got to see the caves, that they would fall in love with it like he did. Mm-hmm. Again, there was that bit of faith that he had that was not necessarily warranted.
Yeah. So then we come to Dick's passing, and I don't mean to stay on Buckner for so long, but I love the sort of sordid history of Buckner and what's been done and all of the progress that's been made at the property and with the cave and everything like that. I think it's a good example of what can be done about a beloved cave, how it can be turned around and how it can be restored to a place where we can all appreciate. So Dick passes, and then you're left with the house.
Well, the RBNC, which the Richard Blends Nature Conservancy, realized that, you know, something was going to have to be done. In fact, before Dick passed, I remember talking to him multiple times, be like, Dick, you know, your house, can I do anything? Can I help you? Can I, you know, and he's like, you know what? I'd really rather just visit. I'd rather we do this. You can clean it up when I'm dead. And I was like, yeah, Dick, that's my worry. But when he passed, he had an executor. We got a phone call late at night that he had passed. Mm-hmm. And we knew that there was a person that had been, you know, listed. So we got a hold of him. His name was Greg Heppner. And he had some of the paperwork, and he was overwhelmed. He hadn't been in Dick's house in a while. And it was pretty overwhelming when we even went in the night before Dick's funeral. the viewing and funeral, to get some things to, you know, have people have pictures and they lay out certain things. Just going in there, I remember looking at everything going, oh my God. At the funeral, we were telling that we would, Mr. Heppner, Greg would tell him that we would help him. And he took us up on it. And because he wasn't a caver. So we let him kind of deal with the legal aspects of it. And there was some paperwork and, you know, the accounts and such. And he gave us some free rein to get in there and get things cleaned up because he didn't know what needed to go where. And of course, we didn't really either. We just had to go in there and start excavating it. And it was like a cave dig. You know, when I discovered the dead mouse that had died and then actually adhered to the finish of the bureau to the point where I had to use a scraper and various chemicals to get it loose. And I think that the fumes got to me because after I cleaned it up, there's the perfect outline of this dead mouse. And so I contemplated getting some yellow tape and putting it around like a little tiny crime scene. and I kept thinking I've probably been working a little too hard on this today. So probably I had to go get some fresh air.
What else from the house cleanup?
Let's see. There was just so much finding all the information about, you know, Dick's history, his childhood, you know, the things that he did, the things that he had collected. We sent one big carload of stuff to the IU music library because he had recordings that were rare that they were real excited to get because his parents had run a record store and you know, the radio.
I didn't know that they ran a record store, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Prior to it was, you know, he helped Dick was born in 24.
Yeah.
He decided at the age of, he said he'd been driving for 82 years and hadn't had any accidents. And I was thinking, Dick, how could you have been driving? He helped his dad deliver milk early on. And what his dad would do is he'd put it in first gear and let 8-year-old Dick drive it down the street. And his dad would jump in and out of the vehicle, you know, as it rolled slowly along and would deliver things to the doorways of people's, you know, houses and such. So you know, Dick had been driving since he was 8.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, the guy wasn't a hoarder or anything, but the house was lived in, you know.
He was in a very eclectic individual with very interesting things that he would collect.
Yeah.
I don't know if you would call it hoarding. There were rooms where you couldn't get in.
Hmm.
There were rooms where you would stand sideways and, you know, get through them like you would through a fat man squeeze and just start. You could get into the kitchen. You could get into the living room. You had to be real careful. His bedroom just had a little narrow path. The room that is now the CIG library, you could not actually step into that room. The room that was the most open was probably his technology room, which is now the BIG library room.
Is that downstairs?
That's upstairs.
That's upstairs. Oh, so that's the room that you go through to get to the CIG library room.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Man.
So it was just, it literally was excavation. Let's see. Sam and I kept track of it to some degree. There were something like 10 full pickup truck loads of just trash that we took. There were 4 pickup loads of metal recycling that went out. There were 2 large trailer loads full of books, non-caving books, that were donated to the library and to the Red Cross book sale. There was, 2 large van loads full of materials and paperwork that went to the NSS headquarters in Huntsville. And this is after, you know, Dick had, while he was still alive, he did get something like 17 to 21 filing cabinets full of the cave surveys and all the cave files. Those went down before he passed. So those, at least, we didn't have to deal with.
That's right, because didn't the Shrewsburys come up with their school bus? and load all those up and bring them down to Huntsville.
Uh-huh. Oh my God. That was a big work day with a lot of people to get all those suckers loaded up.
Wow. It's a wonder there was any room in the house at all.
There wasn't that much. There was a lot of antique furniture from his folks, because Dick was an only child. And so he had gotten a lot of things from there. Beautiful china from, you know, the like 1900.
Wow.
Interesting things. Like something like 25 1-gallon containers of distilled water that he had gotten from the air conditioner. And he had the dates marked on each of those, because I think he was just maybe studying to see how long the distilled water would keep, or in case the end times came. I don't know.
He would collect the water that would come off the air conditioner?
Yeah. And he may have been using, because see, he was on all electric out there.
Yeah.
And so if the electricity failed, and it sometimes did way out there on the end, if he needed water, he would have water. You know, he would still be able to flush toilets and make, you know, himself something to drink and all that. So I think it was just a matter of so many things. I think Dick started to collect and then just got curious and wondered how long and how much and just kept doing it. Other stuff, I think maybe he just never got around to getting rid of it.
You had some volunteers helping you to a degree.
We had regular workday weekends.
A lot of it fell on your shoulders, though.
More of it seemed to fall on my knees. I spent a lot of time on my hands and knees cleaning things and looking under stuff. And I laid both all four floors, from the kitchen, dining room, living room, and then the what's now the library, the BIG library. I did all those floors.
My goodness. How do you feel about the state that it's in now? Like, we're a few years past kind of putting a button on it, right? Or is there more?
Well, the basement can always use some work, because there's still so much stuff that, you know, we'd like to be able to do. We'd like to be able to make that basement more useful as far as maybe a meeting room or something like that. Right now, it's mostly being used for storage. We did build and enclose a full functional bathroom downstairs as well.
Oh, that got done. Okay. I was there.
That got done.
I was helping.
Yeah, there used to just be a toilet.
Yeah.
Open with, you know, no walls.
Well, that's good. That's progress.
So now there's walls and a sink and, you know, everything's been, you know, replaced there and it works. Part of the problem with the basement is when Dick built it, he and his father were more conversant with building up north, where there's different drainage issues. And with the clay soil and things and heavy rains that we get down here, the basement at times would get wet. And so there wasn't as good for storage. Now we've put waterproofing on all the walls, you know, pretty thick. We've done some drains around the perimeter, trying to make it better. So it hasn't flooded in a while, although we do keep a dehumidifier running down there and we can store stuff, but there's no standing water like there used to be.
You got a resident there, right?
We've got two residents. We've got Tom Nugent and his husband, Cody Hudson.
Okay. Gotcha. All right. So you've got, you got a couple people there, which is nice to keep an eye on things.
Mm-hmm.
So what about then? Fascinated by this. I think that there are, you know, I know that there are a lot of cavers who listen to this who kind of got their start at Buckner, like a lot of cavers have. And so I think that this is really interesting for anybody who has a history with Buckner. I don't know. What else can we say about Dick's legacy and the Richard Blends Nature Conservancy?
The wide variety of people that showed up to volunteer and to help and on some horrible rainy days and, you know, doing, you know, some hard work, the wiring, you know, Dick was brilliant when it came to electronics, but he was also a caver. And, you know, that almost, you know, assumes a certain amount of peculiarity. And so some of his electronics that he had in there was very interesting, and very skilled people who worked with electrical engineering and stuff like that would sometimes stand back and look at things that Dick had built and go, I'm not really sure I want to touch that. But, you know, slowly we kind of unraveled a lot of that. The things that we discovered, the things that Dick had built, the Tesla coil, the magnet that he had built that was so powerful it'd break your arm if you tried to, you know, hold on to it too much. His heating system was interesting because it mostly just involved a hole cut in the closet floor of his bedroom and then a large unguarded fan that would either, you know, mostly just suck warm air up from the basement or cool air, you know, depending upon the season. But it was just a huge, scary fan. I made the joke that you could chop up bodies, you know, and just, you know, put them through there. It'd be like a Vegematic.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, if he had tripped and fallen, you know, would have never found him. just the things that he had. So the legacy would be that so many people showed up to help and do things. And there was one person who, because of all the partying that had gone on, there's a lot of broken glass out there.
Mm.
And one person actually constructed sort of a little wagon that she could lay on and with a bucket. And then she would just kind of scoot across on this rolling wagon and just pick up glass out of the dirt and did that for hours, you know, cleaning up the grounds.
Wow.
People up in the trees, you know, with chainsaws, helping trim the tree limbs that had grown up around, the people that helped haul heavy things up and downstairs. It was just a huge labor of love. And a lot of people showed up. We had people come from the Near Normal Grotto. We had Windy City Grotto show up. We had people from Evansville. We had people from Cincinnati, you know, a lot of the CIG, BIG, at the time, the IUSC. We just had people show up and just work their tails off.
I mean, it's so illustrative of the amount of people that property has seen over the last 60 years. You know, so many people have just been there and left their mark for better or for worse. And it took a lot of people power to bring it to a level that is worthy of being called a nature conservancy, I guess, right?
Well, Dick did a lot of work after he retired from IU, after I think 45 years. He did a lot of work out on the property too, which I think gave him some extra years because it kept him out in the fresh air and physically fit. So he was doing a lot to help keep the paths clear and trying to, you know, get some of the underbrush cleared away a little bit. And so he was working on it. It wasn't just after he passed.
Sure.
But yeah, it's been a labor of love for many people for many years.
Are there estimates on the number of people that have been through Buckner?
At one point I heard it was more than 250,000.
I believe it.
Because Dick used to keep track.
Wow.
And I think they pretty much, he stopped at that point.
It's just, it's crazy to me to think that many people have been up Eller Road and gotten to the house and, you know, parked by the barn or what used to be the barn and went through the cave, again, for better or for worse, whether they were there as a responsible visitor or an irresponsible visitor. You know, there are so many people who went there once and were like, I went to a cave one time. I don't know. It just, the fact that many people have made that journey, it's just crazy to me to think about.
Well, on a regular basis, you know, Sam maintains the permission list for people who are asking to go to Buckner now. Mm-hmm. And on at least a weekly basis, he gets contacted by people who say, well, I went there in the 70s, I went there in the 80s, I went there in the 90s, you know, now I want to bring my kids. I want to, you know, check it out. I'm going to be in the neighborhood. There's going to be a reunion of some sort, and they want to come out to the cave. And of course, Sam tries to filter a little bit, because if they actually know what they're doing, he'll grant permission. if it was like, yeah, we really partied there and it was great. And we were wondering whether or not, you know, me and my frat brothers can show up and, you know, have another party up. Then he's a little less welcoming. But we hear from people constantly that have been there in the past and want to come back.
If he gets another message like that, he ought to give him a wire brush. Be like, hey, you can come. Don't bring beer, but try to clean up some of the garbage you left in there last time.
Actually, we do refer an awful lot of people to Bill Bouse, who Bill has been, you know, a wonderful resource as far as putting in time. And he'll take newbies or not very experienced people in, teach them the rudiments, and they will do cleanup. And they do take the wire brushes and they take buckets and they help clean up a lot of the sand that was left when we did the sandblasting.
Yeah.
And they've just done a lot to help get all that cleaned up.
So speaking of Bill and the cleanup effort, like I've noticed that he has intentionally left some places untouched by the cleanup effort. Do you know why that is?
They may either be somewhat of historical value or they may be in sensitive areas where they've just opted not to do it. I don't really know too much about that other than I know he takes groups in a lot and that there's been discussion of preserving some areas because we know that there's stuff underneath that is of historical value and we are afraid that somebody who doesn't know what they're doing very vigorously wire brushing is going to eliminate something that may have been scratched in there 100 years ago.
Okay. Gotcha. I would love to have Bill on to talk about, you know, all of the caving that he's done and some of the work that he's done in Buckner as well. So
good luck. He's even more technology averse than I am. He'd probably have to come over here and do it.
That's okay. I can always come do it in person, which I wish I could have done with you. I appreciate you accommodating. It's not like you're not local, but also I don't have a ton of time. Speaking of which, the reason I don't is because of my kids, and you did a lot of caving with your kids, as we talked about, and there's an awful lot more over the hill from Buckner or under the hill, you know, wherever, all around there. Where else did you visit?
Oh, let's see. I remember a Mother's Day trip to Small and Dull.
Yeah.
Where we had to sneak in to do that. That was before Pike Lumber Company had a stronger presence there. Mm. There was a cave rescue some years back.
Was that Trapdoor?
Well, I've been to Trapdoor a lot. We did a lot of cleanups in Trapdoor. We've done a lot of stuff there in Triple J and Queen Blair, King Blair.
Yeah. But what was the rescue? Forgive me, I kind of interrupted.
It was graduation weekend, I believe, and we got a phone call. I was at Joe Ellen's, and when you get a phone call at a caver's house at 6 a.m. on a Sunday, you generally just start gathering your gear up.
Yeah.
And so there was somebody who had, it was a brother and sister and a school, an older school friend, and a gentleman, a young man from Turkey who was an exchange student. And they had gone caving on, I believe it was Saturday, sometime Saturday, and hadn't come back. And so there were some calls going, we know they were in the general area, and what can we do about it? And I think this must have been in 2001, I think, because I was still studying, and I got to be entrance control when they figured out which cave they were in. And so I sat in the lovely cool air on a very hot summer day and studied criminal procedure while everybody else trooped in and out and worked their tails off to get these people out.
For context, and, you're an attorney.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so they got them out. That was a very interesting time there, too. The poor young man was Turkish, so they're offering him food and stuff, and he's like, I'd really rather have a cigarette. And somebody says, well, we're not allowed to smoke in the cave. And he's like, well, it's a requirement almost. I'm Turkish. You know, we all smoke. And he had to wait until he got all the way out of the cave to get some food that he could eat because the MREs that were taken in contained pork and he could not eat pork.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, but it was a graduation day for the two younger people that were on the trip. And their mother was, once she found out that they had been found safe, she was like, and they are in so much trouble. I went to all this work for this graduation party. And, you know, everybody's sitting here and we're waiting for them to come home. But I think they were pretty happy to get them out.
Yeah. Are you at liberty to say which cave this was?
I think it was Queen Blair.
Okay. Yeah. The only caves I've only been to, I can maybe count on one hand the number of caves that I've been in the Garrison Chapel Valley, which is a shame because there are, you know, dozens of great ones around there and significant ones. Almost all of them are fairly significant. What's the status of a number of them? I mean, you talked about Pike Lumber, and they've really, really got kind of a stranglehold on a good bit of the land there, right?
I think part of it is just liability issues. Plus, they seem to open up the property for their own staff to go hunting out there. So they're probably afraid that some caver is going to be loping through there looking like a deer and get shot while trespassing. So they're really trying hard to, you know, keep us off that property. Another favorite cave that we went to a lot because it was just down the road from where I lived was Leonard Springs Cave. And that was in the back and it's on private property and it was supposed to be off limits. My son Chuck went to the landowner, talked to them, and was given permission for him to go there. And he went there a lot. Again, 12 years old, doing solo caving. With he and Sam conspired because Chuck had talked to him at a cave meeting saying, you know, this is my argument. This is what I want to do. So can you talk to her so she won't freak out so much? And so Sam elicited certain promises from Chuck that he'd be careful. And so then Sam advised me that it'd probably be a good idea to let Chuck go caving because at least then I would know that he was going caving as opposed to Chuck lying and saying, I'm just going on a bike ride and then going caving. So we did that for a lot of years. And so he really knew Leonard Springs Cave very well. Let's see. He was held at knife point by a person evading the law.
Oh my God.
For a while in Leonard Springs Cave, he and his younger brother and their good friend, Josh, a gentleman by the name of Jerry Pelfrey, was wanted by the police and had hidden out in the cave, which was kind of a stupid maneuver since there's really only one way in and out of that cave.
Yeah, but nobody knows that about caves.
Yeah, that's true. They're Hollywood caves, there's always great lights and you know, walking passage. So, you know, they were in the cave and all of a sudden this guy comes up kind of out of the mud and muck and slams Chuck up against the wall, holding a knife to his throat going, who are you? What are you doing here?
Oh, my God.
And, you know, at the tender age of 12, Chuck, you know, talked his way out of it. You know, we're just some little kids and we don't know what we're doing. You know, we're just here in the cave. And by the way, you look hungry. My mom has, you know, all sorts of cookies and stuff at our house. Why don't you let us go and we'll bring you back some food? And so he did. And as soon as they got out, they ran into the law enforcement that were looking for this guy. They just didn't know where the cave entrance was. So Chuck led him back to the cave entrance and said, I got to go. And, you know, he came back and Jerry never got his cookies. And he ended up spending some time in prison. And then when he got out, he killed some people and put their bodies in barrels and, you know, left them there at his property. So he was not a very nice guy.
No, I guess not. Oh, my word. That is horrifying.
It is. It is.
I've heard a lot of stories about caves in that area, and that's one that I've not heard before. Wow.
Well, Chuck would talk about it, but his brother and the friend Josh never liked to talk about it. I think that they were understandably terrified by the whole experience and didn't want to relive it, even in telling a story.
Man, is it hard for you to recount? I mean, because as their mother, that's got to be a kind of a traumatic memory.
I didn't know about it until Chuck came back and said, hey, we're fine. Everything's fine. Cops are up there arresting Jerry Pelfrey. And they didn't tell me much about it until some years had passed. And then Chuck would tell. He was very smart about how much to let me know.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, you know, since he's gone, I don't mind telling stories about him because, you know, they're just stories about him. And that allows me to let other people know what an interesting person he was.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm so sorry for your loss, too, by the way. I was heartened when I saw his ashes being scattered in Buckner. That was really, really special to me. I mean, it brought tears. Sorry about that.
It was one of his favorite caves.
Yeah.
You know, we figure that way he's always with us. And some of his friends have a vial of his ashes that they take with them. So they figure Chuck's still caving with them.
Oh, that's so sweet. Oh my gosh. That's so wonderful. Where was that video that I saw? Where were you scattering his ashes in the cave?
Probably at Buckner. I know that there were some at Sullivan. There were some at Leonard Spring, Endless Cave. And there may be one. I might be possibly Robert's Cave, because I know that we went to the Cave Capers was just like 2 weeks after Chuck died.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know we took some of his ashes there as well.
Mm. So as we mentioned, you are an attorney. How often has your profession and the caving world intersected? I'm sure that you use your knowledge and your designation as a lawyer to your advantage when it comes to managing the property, right?
Oh, a little bit, but actually I use more of my caving experience in dealing with sometimes people get a little volatile and aggressive in court.
Mm.
And sometimes it's not just the people that are, sometimes it's the attorneys. And there is one attorney who will remain nameless, but he's kind of a bully. He's a large guy and he has a tendency to try to loom over people and be intimidating. And he did that to me the first time I was in court with him ever. And I just kind of looked up at him and I went, you know, you standing over there like that just reminds me of the time I was in Peacher's Cave. And there was a very narrow, and I proceeded to talk about how, you know, I had had to, it was originally a 9-inch slot, which I can get through, but I don't like it. So I was, you know, feeling very uncomfortable. So I had to dig. And by the time I get to that point, he has turned an ashen gray color. He's backed up. And, you know, he's clearly really freaked out by it. And, you know, I just use it to intimidate back, I guess.
I love that so much. Like, instead of the law profession informing the caving world, you're using caving world to, oh my gosh, that's poetic right there. I mean,
how I got through the bar exam, I just looked at it as being like a cave rescue. You just got to be here and keep doing what you need to do.
So you're like in the courtroom. You're not just at a desk, like you're the person there handling it. I don't want to get too in the weeds about your profession or anything, but I mean, that takes a certain kind of person.
Yeah, it you know, it's interesting. I work in child support, so I am helping children and doing the best we can to make sure that they get the best opportunities that they can get. And I've advocated for people to get training. I've advocated for people to take their kids caving because, you know, they'll may have a, you know, a kid that's has a lot of energy. And, and this kind of carries out some of Dick Blenz's history, because I know that one time when Chuck was living at Dick's, there was a knock on the door. I think it was summertime here, so it would have been winter in Antarctica. But because this guy was wanting to thank Dick for mentoring him many, many years before, because this guy had been a troubled youth. He was getting into trouble. I can't remember what it was he was doing. But Dick was like, he seems to be very smart. Let's see if we can, you know, guide him into. And so Dick kind of mentored him into electronics and that sort of work. And the guy took to it and ended up being one of the IT specialists that would spend the Antarctic summers in Antarctica and doing their IT stuff. And he firmly placed that as one of Dick's legacies, that, you know, by giving me concern and care, I had a much better life. So I feel like, you know, my work as a child support attorney just kind of helps carry that forward.
Wow. Do you see caving as a potential confidence builder for troubled youth? Like, here's something that'll show you what you're made of.
Oh, heavens, yes. It's a confidence builder for four-year-olds. When we went caving in Buckner, there was a, when my kids were six and four, my youngest son, we'd been in there like 5-6 hours and he was tired. He was cold. He was wet. He was just, he didn't want to go. And we just had one little section left to get through that was kind of sketchy to him, but he didn't want to do it. And I was tired and everything. And I finally just kind of roared at him, look, you're going to do it. 4 years old. He crawls through it. When he came out, he was a man. You could tell, you know, the sense of accomplishment. He was fine with it from that point on.
It could go either way there. You know, he could get something from it, or it could be traumatized by it. And it sounds like it went the right direction. And that's good.
Well, he allowed me to take his daughter caving when she was 12 months old.
Oh, wow. Goodness gracious. That's wonderful. All right. So outside of Indiana, what have you done caving wise?
I've caved in Missouri. I've caved in Kentucky. I've caved in Tennessee. I've caved in West Virginia. I've caved in not much in Illinois. Let's see. Where else have I caved? New Mexico. I lived in New Mexico for 6 months.
Oh, wow.
Never got to do Leche Guía.
Well, okay.
Did get to go to Slaughter Canyon Cave and worked on the Gyp Cap project for a little bit. I do not like gypsum caves. They are, have you ever been in a gypsum cave?
I guess I haven't, no.
The gypsum is a very lightweight stone. So it's kind of like caving in stale marshmallows that have only been lightly stuck together. So trying to map it, you know, even as you're crawling through it, it's real fragile. And so you could break it as you go along. And then there's the rattlesnakes.
Oh, good heavens. Yeah. All right. Nope. Although I was down in Tag one time. I think it was at Flowing Stone, and you know, we're just, you know, you go and do that. There's a lot of sitting and waiting at the entrance while somebody climbs up or heads down. And I was sitting there for 10 minutes, and right next to me was a timber rattler just coiled up. And I looked down and I caught eyes with him, and it was as if we were speaking to each other. You're cool. I'm cool. Cause if you're cool, I'm cool. We're all right, man. I'm not going to do anything to you unless you do something to me. But yeah, that's a startling thing.
Mm-hmm.
Any highlights aside from the New Mexico?
They're all interesting. They're all beautiful. There was one cave and I don't write down the names of the caves and stuff, but I think it was like Big Brushy Creek or something, but you went through water. I'm a short person, so I was in water up to my neck. And then we entered into a room and there's a waterfall coming from the ceiling. And with all of our lights, and it was just pretty magical. It was kind of a sad thing. I was part of the cave rescue for Tim McLean down at Binkley.
Oh, yeah.
And it was bitterly cold. And I did not go into the cave. My job was to stay outside and be basically support as cavers were coming out. I had a fire going. It was so cold that as people were coming out of the cave and they're sopping wet, their hands and knees were freezing to the rocks as they were crawling out.
Wow.
So they would just be shivering. So they would literally stand over the fire and start to thaw. And then the steam would rise. And it was a very clear, beautiful, starlit night. But because of that steam rising, we had snowfall right in that little spot.
Oh, my goodness.
And then after the hours and hours of work getting Tim McLean's body to the entrance, the people who had been on that cave trip with him, they were the ones that carried his body from the entrance to the top of the hill. And it was just a very somber but beautiful thing where he was being, you know, he'd gone into the cave with these people. He was coming out of the cave with these people that he loved and that loved him so very much. And it was very moving to me to see that level of dedication and care. Mm.
Like when I think about that cave, because what some people might not know about that cave is that, you know, that was Blowing Hole, right? That they pulled him out of Blowing Hole in Indiana.
I think so.
Yeah. And there's water there. And in the wintertime, it likes to suck air in and mm-hmm. freeze that water. And one thing that you could do at Blowing Hole is go in that entrance in the wintertime and slide on the ice for a little while because it does freeze there. And I can't imagine having to also do a body recovery under those conditions. My goodness.
Being able to see the cooperation of the way cavers work together. I tell people it sounds weird that when I say I really love a cave rescue, but what I love about it is the fact that people show up and they work together, and the first person there, you know, naturally becomes the incident commander until they give that obligation and responsibility over to somebody that they believe is more capable. But up until that point, you know, it may be a short order cook, and the next person who shows up may be, you know, whatever, but they defer, the egos are suppressed, and people just say, what do you need me to do? And then they do it. Mm-hmm. And that level of cooperation is not something that you see most places. Caving has been my salvation. You know, it allowed me to realize that I did have something to contribute. I didn't have to be the best. I didn't have to be the brightest. I didn't have to be the most capable of anything. I had to show up and I had to try. And that was respected and appreciated. And so to me, it's just a beautiful thing. And it's part of the reason why I go caving and I do what I can, because I tell people, you know, that well, why do you go caving? And I say, well, partly it's because of the people you meet inside a cave. You know, they've already self-filtered out the vast majority of people that you're not going to get along with all that well, because the people in the cave, they're like you. They're like me.
I love that illustration so much. I mean, that we talked about caving being a confidence builder for kids. I mean, you just illustrated the fact that that's what it did for you as well. Do you think you would have ended up in the profession that you're in right now? Because I guess caving came first before you became an attorney. Did caving, would you say, give you the confidence to pursue your professional life now?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know, once you've dealt with certain things, having had a bad marriage before, you know, marrying Sam also contributes, because, you know, I'd go to law school and some of my classmates, you know, one lady got a streak of white hair, you know, from just sitting and watching, you know, I saw her go gray over the semester.
Wow.
Would be so intimidated by the professors and so scared. And I would think, there's nothing they can throw at me. You know, it's like I'm not stuck underground. You know, I'm not going to die in here. They can't hit me. They can't steal from me. You know, they can't yell at me. They certainly can't humiliate me worse than I've ever been humiliated. So, you know, what's to lose? Just raise your hand and do the best you can.
The perspective that caving can give you, anyone, you know, someone, is invaluable. I love that so much. Patty, thank you so much. This has been insightful. I appreciate all the information about Buckner and Dick, and I'm just fascinated by that world and that history. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome. It was my pleasure.
Oh, Patty, the pleasure was all mine. Thank you so much. And thank you, Patty, for your patience in me dropping this episode. We talked months ago. I think it may have been the end of last year. And there were so many other interviews that were sort of more timely with things that were coming up. So I kept putting hers on the back burner. And I really appreciate you waiting for that one. And thank you for listening to it. This is a monthly podcast. I'll be back on October the 1st with an episode from Trey Hinke. If you heard the Capers 2021 episode that I did, you heard a short talk with Trey. This was a full hour that took place at Indiana Cave Capers 2023. I was working registration. He came up and I said, and I had my recorder. I said, you want to talk? And he said, yeah, let's talk. Because the dude is about to move to Mexico. I don't know when it's going to happen, But I wanted to drop this episode before he moves, which, you know, it could be he's hoping to get down there before the end of the year. And we talk about that. We talk about his experience on the show Naked and Afraid. Yeah, he was on that show. And he was on another show where he actually got to go caving. And we talk about his girlfriend who tragically passed away a little over a year ago and his storied and adventurous caving life, much of which has been spent in Indiana's longest cave, Binkley. And he was part of that rescue that took place in 2016. We talk about it. We talk about all of it. Me and Trey Hinkey next month. Thanks to our sponsor, Sophie Reaptress. Get you a cave suit at sophiereaptress.com. Thanks to our past sponsor, Swego, swegogear.com. Get you a nice Swego pack. Organic Robot Designs in Greenfield, Indiana. If you need t-shirts for a grotto fundraiser, Charlie will hook you up. Organicrobotdesigns.com. Thank you to El Spelio Lights, who are now being sold by OnRope One. And I think that ought to do her. I wish I could tell you I'll see you at Tagfall Cave-In, but I won't. I won't be there. Enjoy yourself. And again, if you're on your way to or from OTR, thanks for tuning in. My name's Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. Until next time, kill nothing but time.